How's everybody doing today? Welcome back to another episode of The Banker Next Door. Today we're going to be doing the Lords of Easy Money Part 9, and we're going to be starting Part 2 of the book, and we're going to be getting in today. We're covering Chapter 7, which is called The Quantitative Quagmire, and we're going to be covering the years of 2012 through 2014. So I'm going to bring in a little PowerPoint slide here. So this is just a quick overview here of Part 2. We're going to be covering the chapters Quantitative Quagmire, The Fixer, The Risk Machine, The ZERP Regime, The Honig Rule, and then we'll be wrapping up Part 2 with Totally Normal. And so let's go into... Okay, so here we are. Part 2, The Age of ZERP, and I'm going to be kicking off here. So... the Fed governors work out of well-appointed offices that line a long hallway in the Eshel's building near the cavernous, ornate boardroom. Though they work on the same floor of the same building, the governors didn't simply pop into one another's offices to ask for advice or share a thought. Discussions were set up by appointment through the governor's assistants. One of Powell's neighbors as a governor was Elizabeth Betsy Duke, a former bank executive and chairwoman of the American Bankers Association. Duke said she was struck by just how isolated it was to be a Fed governor. "It was the loneliest job I ever had," she recalled. So, and again, that's just to give you kind of, again, a taste of the culture of the Fed. You know, they're, you know, even though these people work in this beautiful grand building, even though they're literally right down the hall from each other, they don't communicate in terms of, I guess, what we would consider like a normal corporate environment. You know, it's not like, oh, I'm just going to walk down the door and knock on the, you know, the chief lending officer's door and just say, hey, you know, I want to talk about this deal or something like that. No, it definitely did not work like that. So the social atmosphere was a strained one, but Jeremy Powell managed to fit into it smoothly. This was one of his primary skills in life. Powell was charming, smart, and even humble in a way, with a self-effacing humor that was impossible to fake. Everybody called him Jay. He had spent his career inside the corridors of American power, moving back and forth between the institutions of big government and big money. He grew up in the wealthy suburbs of Washington, D.C., attended Georgetown Law, and then went to work on Wall Street in the investment world. After that, he had a senior position in the U.S. Treasury Department under the first president, George Bush. He then jumped to a very powerful private equity firm called the Carlyle Group. Carlyle was so rich and run by a group of Washington insiders who were so powerful that it spawned a number of conspiracy theories that were surpassed only by the Federal Reserve. That's very true. After his time at Carlyle, Powell was very wealthy and joined a think tank in D.C. He was nominated to be a Fed governor by Barack Obama as part of a compromise deal. Obama nominated one liberal, a Harvard professor named Jeremy Stein, and one conservative who was Jay Powell. So Powell has a very different background, and we're going to get on that. We'll get later on. You'll see, like, the next chapter in the book basically covers Jeremy Powell's entire story, his background, and everything. But Powell was, as I would say, probably unlike any Fed president that there has been up to this point. You know, most of the almost all, I think, of the Fed presidents that have been are, you know, kind of very well established PhDs. Went from academia into government work, you know, definitely blurred that line going back and forth, you know, writing a lot of academic papers, you know, especially when you look at Greenspan and Bernanke and even Janet Yellen. Jeremy Powell, you know, he doesn't have a PhD in economics. Jeremy Powell, we're going to see, like, you know, he just kind of, you know, got his undergrad degree and then got a law degree and then went to work for some private equity firms, worked for the Carlyle Group, worked for a think tank, and then got appointed to the board of the governors of the Federal Reserve. You know, so he did not follow what I would call a traditional path to the head of the Federal Reserve the way a lot of other people have. Now, Powell is, like you said, he's very well spoken. He has kind of a good sense of humor. He has a kind of like an endearing quality about him. As a lawyer, as you can imagine, very good with has a very good vocabulary, very good with words. So he's able to pick up all of the economic lingo and regurgitate that in a very good way. But as we're going to find out, I think, as good meaning as Jeremy Powell is. And I think Jeremy Powell is a very kind of level-headed kind of guy. And we're going to see that as we move through the chapter here. But he definitely, how do you want to say it? Like he doesn't have the bona fides, I think, of people before him in understanding a lot of the economic concepts and the things that are going on there on a grander scale. But like I said, we'll get into that more in depth later on. So now we got forward guidance and Operation Twist. So Powell arrived at the Fed in May of 2012, just as the FOMC was entering a period of tense debate. Ben Bernanke was pushing for a new, much larger round of quantitative easing, but he was facing an unprecedented amount of dissent within the committee. Debates inside the FOMC that summer revealed a remarkable level of skepticism and outright opposition to Bernanke's plan. Bernanke began to push hard against his opposition because economic growth remained weak and the unemployment rate remained high, almost 4 years after the crash of 2008. This long period of anemic growth was entirely expected and predictable because of the big debt overhang that remained from the housing bubble. But Bernanke felt pressure to act and to keep the Federal Reserve at the center of efforts to boost the American economy. To achieve this, Bernanke pushed the Fed to use tools that were once considered experimental, even radical, but were now the only tools at the Fed's disposal. The Fed had already employed two of its most powerful tools by the time Powell arrived. The first was forward guidance, whereby the Fed guaranteed that it would keep rates low, encouraging more lending and speculation. In January, the Fed had signaled it would keep rates at zero for nearly three more years, an extraordinary escalation of the guidance. The second tool was Operation Twist, a bond buying program similar to quantitative easing, but with one important difference. Operation Twist didn't pump more cash into the banking system, but only sought to encourage more lending by pushing down the interest rates on long-term treasury bills. The Fed had launched Operation Twist in late 2011 and extended it into 2012. So let's take a sidebar here for a second. So the way Operation Twist worked is that the Fed bought long-term T-bills and then simultaneously sold an equal amount of short-term treasuries into the market. This maneuver was the twist. The Fed was taking long-term bills out of the market, which lowered the interest rate on those bills by increasing demand for them. But the fact that it was selling an equal value of short-term bills ensured that it wasn't increasing the total supply of new cash in the banking system. Every dollar the Fed added through a long-term T-bill purchase, it took away with a short-term T-bill sale. The goal was to dissuade investors from saving money in the 10-year treasury bill while not flooding the banking system with cash. So Operation Twist was very interesting. It was a very interesting program that they used, and they used it very effectively to manipulate interest rates. But again, the idea was they wanted to stop investors from saving money in a 10-year bill. In other words, what we talked about last time with removing the risk-free rate from the market, they wanted to remove the risk-free rate. They wanted to drive people into riskier investments. They wanted people to take out debt. They wanted people to put more money into the stock market, into riskier things. They wanted asset inflation. They did not want people keeping their money huddled in savings accounts or keeping them in T-bills. Like that's not what they wanted people to do. And they were dramatically manipulating the long and short rates to achieve that end. Now the forward guidance for a second is a very interesting thing because that was something new that was initiated at this time by the Federal Reserve, particularly by Ben Bernanke, to try to kind of set the stage for things that were to come that the Fed was going to do. And the media just, they gobbled it up. And we're seeing in a few minutes, why this became more necessary. But just, you know, remember forward guidance, Operation Twist. So, okay. The QE is now a normal tool of monetary policy. So, but as the summer rolled around, Bernanke needed something more. Bernanke began to push for a larger, longer-lasting round of quantitative easing, arguing that maybe this new round would accomplish what the previous round had not. Quantitative easing had now become a normal tool of monetary policy that had even earned its own shorthand description at the Fed and on Wall Street, where people simply referred to it as QE. But even as it was normalized, internal dissent against QE was growing inside the FOMC. Bernanke faced resistance from Fed governors and multiple regional bank presidents. This growing dispute put pressure on Jay Powell to figure out where he stood and to figure it out quickly. Powell began to work closely with Betsy Duke, a vocal critic of quantitative easing. Both Powell and Duke had come to the Fed from the world of private banking and finance. So they shared a certain sensibility and a technical understanding about the way the Fed influenced the real world of hedge funds and banks. It seemed to be this knowledge that made them skeptical about another round of QE. In other words, i.e., Betsy and Jay came from the real world. They had worked in the real world and they saw and understood the effects of what the Fed was doing to the real world, unlike all of the academics and the other people that had worked at the Fed that had never worked in the real world, had only worked for government their entire careers and maybe academia, and were in a certain extent, even though very smart about the way things worked, certain kind of oblivious to the way the ramifications of some of the policies as they get enacted. Betsy was worried that more QE would just build up more risk in the financial system without doing all that much to help the real economy. She was also deeply worried that the Fed didn't seem to have an exit plan. Quantitative easing was easy to execute, but difficult to reverse, or almost impossible to reverse, as we would find out. And reversing QE became more difficult the larger the problem became. Duke's concerns were amplified by two other regional bank presidents, Richard Fisher from Dallas and Jeffrey Lacker from Richmond. Okay, now we're going to get into what Bernanke's plans and what he called his option B. So Jay Powell had an outsized influence in this debate because he was a governor. Bernanke focused his energy on lobbying the governors to get behind his plan in a way that safely neutralized any objections that might come from cantankerous regional bank presidents such as Tom Hawning. That was the way the Bernanke Fed worked, Betsy Duke recalled. You didn't have dissent from any of the governors. Bernanke viewed it as a particularly big deal. He said he didn't want dissents. When Bernanke lobbied the Fed governors, the lobbying was aimed at a particular goal. The goal was to build unanimous support among the governors for something called Option B. When the FOMC members gathered for their official meetings, they generally considered three policy options before voting on one. The options are labeled A, B, and C and arranged like Goldilocks porridge, ranging from hottest to coldest in their effect on the monetary supply. Option A was usually the most aggressive, like a round of QE that would be worth $1.5 trillion, while Option C would be extremely conservative, like doing no QE at all. Option B was always structured to be just right. Bernanke spent his time between meetings formulating an option B that satisfied the governors and guaranteed their votes when the meeting came around. The objective always for the meeting is to come out with option B, Betsy said. Bernanke was willing to accept one dissenting vote from a regional bank president, but not much more than that. And the reason being is because if he got much more than that, his decisions and the policy would be in jeopardy. So, okay, so now let's move on to Powell's first meeting and Bernanke's persuasion. So in his very first meeting at the FOMC, Powell was diplomatic and warm. He voted for option B. Powell opened his remarks with something that would become a habit of his. He talked about what his friends and contacts were saying in the private sector. He often surveyed his contacts with precision and rigor. In one meeting, he broke down their responses by percentage, like a Gallup opinion poll. During his first meeting in May, Powell said the QE should be reserved as a backup tool, something to be used as a defensive weapon going forward. He indicated that the weapon was probably not needed now. His industry contacts said that the growth was slow, but he wasn't convinced the slowdown would last into 2023. Bernanke lobbied the governors between meetings. He lobbied them as a politician might do, building support for his cause and seeking to isolate opponents who might hinder it. The FOMC discussions were open and transcribed for history, but Bernanke's private meetings were not. This allowed people to speak freely. Betsy Duke very much enjoyed these meetings. Even when she disagreed with Bernanke, he was a great listener. When Bernanke tried to persuade the Fed governors, he did so respectfully and intelligently. He presented them studies, and he read the studies that they provided in response. He called them unexpectedly. He traded emails and debates. The process wasn't necessarily contentious. Duke and her colleagues were not an easy sell on QE. Everyone seemed to agree that you had declining benefits, she recalled, and those tiny benefits came with large risks down the road. The concerns were, how do you exit? How do you stop? One of Bernanke's secret weapons in the lobbying effort was his vice chairman, Janet Yellen, the former president of the San Francisco Fed. Yellen was an assertive and convincing surrogate for Bernanke, and she championed an expansive use of the Fed's powers. Janet was the strongest advocate for unlimited quantitative easing, Duke recalled. Janet would be very forceful. She is very confident, very strong in promoting the point of view. Yellen and Bernanke were convincing, and their argument rested on a simple point. In the face of uncertainty, the Fed had to err on the side of action. Bernanke pushed this view to Duke, along with other wavering FOMC members like the regional bank presidents Sandra Pianalto of Cleveland, Dennis Lockhart of Atlanta, and Narayana Kakarlakota of Minneapolis. I'm sorry if I got that wrong. All this lobbying meant that the key policy decision makers was essentially finished by the time the regional bank presidents traveled to Washington to vote. The regional president seems to sense this fact, and they tailored their criticisms to affect future votes or give cover to Fed governors who might want to break ranks. So again, we're seeing kind of the inner working of the politics here at the Fed. You know, Ben Bernanke was adamant that there was not going to be any dissent from the Fed governors, and he lobbied all these people, and his best friend Janet Yellen there. And we're gonna learn a lot more about Miss Yellen as we go on here, just as we will learn a lot more about Jay Powell. But the important thing to understand about the three of them is that they become thick as thieves, and they were the three last. They were the chain of leaders through the Fed, and we're gonna get back to the three of them at the very end. But let's go on here with Richard Fisher's case study and the Fed's culture of sophistication. Richard Fisher, the Dallas Fed president, had grown adept at this art. Fisher didn't just argue the philosophical merits of the Fed's ZERP policies. He presented a specific, detailed case study illustrating how the policies were already causing dangerous distortions in the economy. Fisher said that he had recently spoken with the chief financial officer of Texas Instruments, who explained how the company was managing money in the age of ZERP. The company had just borrowed $1.5 billion in cheap debt, but it didn't plan to use the cash to build a factory, invest in research, or hire workers. Instead, the company used the money to buy back shares of its own stock. This made sense because the stock paid a dividend of 2.5%, while the debt only cost between 0.45% and 1.6% to borrow. It was a finely played maneuver of financial engineering that increased the company's debt, drove up its stock price, and gave a handsome reward to shareholders. Fisher drove home the point by relating his conversation with the CFO. I'm not going to use it to create a single job. Let me say that again. I'm not going to use it to create a single job, Fisher reported. And I think this is the issue. We work under the assumption that lowering the cost of capital and providing cheap money encourages businesses to lever up and to use that leveraging to expand, in other words, capital investment and job creation, which is part of our mandate. I don't believe that's happening. Fisher was describing specifically how ZERP was already building up systemic risk in the economy without creating a single job. Bernanke rarely responded directly to such statements, but in this case, he made an exception. Thank you, Bernanke said. President Fisher, I know we put a lot of value on anecdotal reports. I love that. Anecdotal reports around this table, and often to great credit. But I do not want to urge you. I do want to urge you not to overweigh the macroeconomic opinions of private sector people who are not trained in economics. You have to love this. Anecdotal reports do not overweight the macroeconomic opinions of private sector people. This is the CFO of Texas Instruments. Okay, this is not some schmo on the street. Private sector people who are not trained in economics. So in other words, the CFO of Texas Instruments, a company that's been around for, I don't know, 50, 60, 70 years, is a moron and couldn't simply grasp the basic concepts of economics and how he should use the money, even though he just came up with this brilliant piece of financial engineering and basically saying, yeah, I'm going to take out this debt and I'm just going to use it to buy our stock and pay us all back very handsomely. Like, you know, with this comment, Bernanke seemed to have inflicted upon Fisher the most humiliating wound possible in the culture of the FOMC. He had exposed Richard Fisher as being unsophisticated. Neither Fisher nor presumably the CFO of Texas Instruments had earned a PhD in economics. Oh, heaven forbid. Heaven forbid. This put them at a supposed disadvantage when it came to comprehending the effects of programs like quantitative easing. They just were simple. They were total simpletons. The Fed's leadership sometimes acted as if the army of trained economists at the Feds, up to and including its chairman, could understand the design and the effects of the Fed's actions. The implied superiority of economists was a very real force at the Fed, on display at every FOMC meeting when PhD-trained staff gave long and minutely detailed presentations about the policy choices at hand. Without a PhD in economics, according to one former governor, the Fed staff will run technical rings around you. Conte Brown wrote in his 2017 book, The Power and the Independence of the Federal Reserve, this power was also directed against critics like Powell and Duke, who came from the world of banking rather than academia. During the July meeting, Jay Powell took a measured approach. He bluntly acknowledged that QE would stoke economic growth primarily by first stoking asset prices. I suspect that the channels that we're using now, which principally are asset prices, may not be working at all as well as our models say. QE was building up risks in the economy, he continued, but the risks were probably manageable. Still, he didn't think another round of QE was necessary. And for me, I think that the bar for another large LSAP is high and not yet met, he said, using an alternative acronym for QE. LSAP stands for Large Scale Asset Purchase, and people at the Fed use it interchangeably with QE. Bernanke did believe that the bar had been met, but by late July, he could still not... By July, he still could not push the FOMC to agree with him. Bernanke had a chance to change this in late August when he was invited to speak at the prestigious Jackson Hole retreat. He had used this venue to build support for quantitative easing in 2010. Now he would do it again. So to take a step back there, so again, you have this, what I would describe as a very snotty, elitist type culture at the Fed where, you know, the academic PhDs rule the roost. And, you know, how it's kind of like, you know, how dare you come in and bring in some other evidence that we did not find in our data points and other kind of nonsense or whatever. And, you know, and you begin again, it's important to understand, you have to understand this culture because it really gets into how decisions get made and why people don't dissent and why different things don't happen in different ways at the Federal Reserve. And this is why, because you get people that come in without certain, academic backgrounds, i.e. PhD in economics and finance and things like that. And these people get looked down upon even when they're bringing in highly credible information, it's still not good enough. It's like, yeah, no, that ain't going to work. And we're just going to get, we're just going to brush that aside. And Ben Bernanke in this meeting, basically that was the equivalent of, you know, just slapping this Fed governor across the face and just saying like, yeah, dude, no, I don't care what evidence you bring in. This is garbage. And we're just tossing this aside. So, anyway, so now, We're going to get into Ben Bernanke's speech at Jackson Hole. So even at Jackson Hole, there was deep dispute about what the Fed was doing. Some economists argued the QE wasn't even achieving its primary goal of lowering long-term rates. Others argued that it had done that, but wasn't creating any meaningful gains for the economy. Bernanke's speech that year was presented as an assessment of the Fed's actions since 2008. It carried a neutral title, Monetary Policy Since the Onset of the Crisis. Bernanke purported to weigh the benefits and the costs of policies like quantitative easing, forward guidance, and Operation Twist. He seemed to be very careful not to use common English or to talk about what the Fed was doing in a way that might accidentally be understood by anyone without an advanced degree in economics. To give just a flavor, when Bernanke described the way the QE affected markets, he said, "One mechanism through which such purchases are believed to affect the economy is the so-called portfolio balance channel. The key premise underlying this channel is that for a variety of reasons, different classes of financial assets are not perfect substitutes in investors' portfolios." Bernanke's very dense speech outlined the potential benefits and the potential drawbacks of QE. The approach helped his campaign to build more support for QE precisely because the benefits and costs were so hard to measure. One economist's asset bubble was another's healthy market. His speech meandered through this ambiguous terrain until Bernanke uttered one line that would truly move markets. Overall, however, a balanced reading of the evidence supports the conclusion that central bank securities purchased have provided meaningful support to the economic recovery while mitigating deflationary risks, he said. This was the statement that would be carried on the top of the Wall Street Journal story on Jackson Hole. Bernanke was saying the QE worked. He was also saying that the Fed would not rule out the further use of such policies. It was a clear signal to Wall Street that the traders ought to hitch up their horses and get ready to ride. Bernanke's speech overrode the deep divisions on display inside the FOMC by fueling the so-called announcement effect. This happens when the very hint of a new action from the Fed changes what investors expect, which then makes the market prices start to change. Bernanke had benefited from this effect in 2010 when he fed the expectation that another round of QE was on the way, causing some stock and bond prices to rise. This meant that not initiating another round of QE would cause prices to fall, putting a very heavy burden on any FOMC member who might vote no. So again, great tactic used by Bernanke here, the so-called announcement effect. You know, they have these press conferences and then everybody on Wall Street is hanging on the every word like, oh my gosh, what's he going to say? What's he going to do? And so Bernanke used this tactic very effectively. And what the net effect is, it puts a lot of pressure on the anybody who would even think about dissenting now has to think twice because the effect could be so profound. It could literally cause markets to drop, could wealth to disappear. And we'll see this, we're going to see this very large in a few minutes. And basically what happens to Betsy Duke, where we'll see this. So now, Bernanke justified what he was doing by pointing to two very large economic threats, one foreign and one domestic. The foreign threat came from Europe. The domestic threat came from Congress. In Europe, the financial crisis of 2008 had never really ended. The debt overhang in Europe was simply astounding. Just three European banks had taken on so much debt before 2008 that their balance sheets amounted to 17% of the entire world's GDP. Europe was crippled for years. European banks and governments owed their debt in dollars, so the European Central Bank couldn't just create more dollars to bail them out as the Fed had done in the United States. The Fed had been working hard to stop the bleeding, extending the swap lines that flooded Europe with dollars, but there was only so much the swap lines could do. By 2012, Europe was at a risk of entering a doom loop, whereby failed government loans would damage the banks, which in turn would suffer huge losses and drag down growth, making it even harder for the governments to pay off further debt. As always, this threatened the United States because a massive European downturn would hurt demand for US goods. The second threat, the domestic threat, was even more urgent. The Tea Party movement had effectively neutralized Congress. The only acceptable public policy plan in the eyes of the Tea Party leaders was to cut taxes, cut government spending, and reduce government regulation. In the summer of 2011, the Tea Party pushed its crusade into new terrain, threatening to default on the federal government's debt if the Obama administration and the Democratic-controlled Senate did not adopt Tea Party policies. This fight was centered on what was once a routine vote to pay the government's bills, a vote known as raising the debt ceiling. The term was misleading. The vote wasn't to increase overall spending and debt, but just to finance the spending to which the government was already committed. A debt default loomed for the first time in American history. This catastrophe was only averted when the White House and the Tea Party reached a very strange compromise. Congress agreed to pay its bills, but only if a time bomb, was installed in the federal budget. This time bomb was a series of automatic spending cuts that were so draconian and irresponsible that even many Republicans couldn't live with them. Bernanke called the looming budget cuts, which totaled about $500 billion, the fiscal cliff. The cuts amounted to about 3 or 4% of all economic growth in the United States. Economists feared such cuts would push the country immediately into recession. Bernanke believed that the Fed needed to have the courage to act. Public perceptions began to harden that more QE was coming, and the Wall Street traders began to focus their attention on the Fed's next meeting in September when they expected this QE to be announced. Bernanke had used dense economic language to promote QE publicly. Now his team would use the same approach internally with the FOMC. The Fed's economists were already working on a presentation steeped in numbers and full of charts to present at the next meeting. The presentation told a story about QE that was very hopeful and also almost entirely wrong. So a lot to unpack right there. So you got these two threats. You know, Europe's a hot mess. I would even argue that, you know, has Europe ever really recovered from the financial crisis of 2008? And I think the answer to that is probably no. I mean, there's still, things are better today, but they're still struggling. A lot of their banks still have a lot of problems. And then the second thing, you know, and again, and this is the one thing in the book that I knock Christopher Leonard on. I mean, he's obviously very left-leaning. His language, especially as he describes Republicans and their actions, is he uses what I think is very extreme language a lot of times. They did this radical thing and they were threatening and their crusade they put this time bomb in there and they were going to do this and do that. Like, do you ever notice how whenever anybody brings up that they want the federal government to get money under control, it immediately becomes this like, oh my gosh. It almost becomes this hysterical argument of like, how could we do this? And they were simply talking about cutting $500 billion, which was about 3 or 4% of economic growth in the United States. And the economists immediately go into panic mode. Oh my gosh, this is going to cause a recession. Just so everybody understands, cutting $500 billion or 3 or 4%, that's nothing. That is nothing. That is like you cutting your Netflix subscription. Okay. It would not have done anything. It really wouldn't. It would not have ultimately changed anything that happened. And again, you see these fear mongers. I mean, even now, when you talk about, oh, we got to cut spending, we got to get it under control, immediately the talking heads and the bought and paid for economists and all these other people out there, they immediately come out, go into full overdrive mode, full hysterics. Oh, we can't cut this. If you cut spending, it's the end of the world. Everything will collapse. And heaven forbid if you disappoint Wall Street, right? Heaven forbid Wall Street doesn't get there. They don't get, it's important to note that during this whole QE phase and even afterwards, I mean, Wall Street really became like a junkie. You know, they became a total junkie and they had to get their QE fix. They had to get their shot. Otherwise, if they didn't get their QE, then everything was gonna melt down or whatever. And you're gonna see that. We're gonna talk about the taper tantrum in a few minutes here. But let's keep moving on here. So September 2012. So on September 12th. The members of the FOMC gathered in Washington, D.C. for the regular policy meeting. Bernanke and Yellen were pushing for an open-ended program. Early versions of the much-polished Option B called for a QE plan that had no set end date. The open-ended nature of the plan was meant to be a compromise with those who objected to it. The idea was that the Fed could readjust or even end the program if it proved to be unnecessary. The meeting opened with a long presentation from two Fed economists that seemed designed to settle any doubts about the new round. The study was framed as a scientifically rigorous forecast of what another round of quantitative easing might do and how long it would last. It used rigorous academic language and was full of precise measurements and graphs. But this presentation, for all its detail, was catastrophically wrong in virtually every important prediction that it made. Catastrophically wrong in virtually every important decision that it made, revealing the grave mistakes at all points in the same direction. And it was a direction that would help Bernanke push his case. The presentation was written by Seth Carpenter and Michelle Ezer. Carpenter presented their findings to the FOMC. He was a relatively young economist, but his PhD from Princeton and years of working as a Fed researcher gave him a firm command of complex issues. His demeanor and his vocabulary exuded expertise and cool competence. The jargon he employed was almost numbingly intimidating, as when he pointed out at the beginning of his presentation that the staff analysis starts from a term structure model that embeds Treasury and MBS supply factors as determinants of the yield curve. The forecast predicted that short-term interest rates would remain pinned at zero throughout 2013 and 2014 as the new round of QE was rolled out. But after that, the forecast predicted that the rates would start to climb again, rising until they reached historically normal levels around the year 2017. Things would get fully back to normal by about 2018 when short-term rates would return to roughly 4.5% or higher. This was magical thinking. In reality, the Fed funds rate stayed at 0.4% until the end of 2016. By the middle of 2018, the rate had only risen to less than 2% or half the rate that was forecast. This same pattern of error held true for other key metrics, like the average rate on a 30-year home loan. This was forecast to drop at first, but then rise steadily until 2020, when the rates would be above 6%. In reality, home loan rates rose during 2013, but then stalled out and fell steadily until 2015 when they hit 3.6%. The rate never hit the 6% that was forecast and was only 3.5% by early 2020. The gravest error had to do with the Fed's balance sheet, which reflected just how many bonds the Fed would buy and conversely, how many new dollars it would inject into the financial system. Carpenter and Ezer focused on the value of the account used by the Fed traders in New York. The Fed predicted that its holdings would expand quickly during 2013 and then level off at around $3.5 trillion after the Fed was done buying bonds. After that, the balance sheet would start to shrink gradually as the Fed sold off all the assets it bought, falling to under $2 trillion by 2019. In reality, the value of assets in the Fed account exploded far faster and far more than the Fed expected, hitting $4.2 trillion by 2016. The account remained at that high level, virtually unchanged, until February of 2018. In other words, the SOMA account became about twice as large as the Fed expected it, and it never shrank in the way that the Fed had forecast. In other words, quantitative easing is very easy to get into, and incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to get out of. So they blew up their balance sheet, and there's not a good way to get out of it. There was a final important error on Carpenter's presentation, and it assumed that the rate of price inflation would fall during 2012, but then start to rise again, continuing to rise steadily through 2015. At that point, it would level off and hover around 2%, which happened to be the level the Fed was targeting at its policies. This never happened. Never happened. The inflation rate lagged below the Fed target of 2% for most of the period between 2012 and 2020. The rate was still 1.9% by December of 2019. This last error carried profound consequences. The rate of price inflation was basically the only external brake that could be applied to the ZIRP policies. If consumer prices started to rise, then external pressure would build for the Fed to raise interest rates and undo quantitative easing. But that didn't happen. The Fed would keep interest rates at zero and keep buying bonds. So again, it was price inflation. That was the only thing that was going to stop or really put a dramatic pause on quantitative easing. And it just did not happen. It just did not get there. So, okay. Now we get to, even as Carpenter walked through his presentation, he peppered his commentary with caveats and warnings. He tried to explain that the forecasts were merely educated guesses. The forecast was based on theoretical models, and those models were based on certain assumptions about the way the world worked. But there is layering model upon model to try to get these effects, he said after the presentation. When asked about the presentation years later, Seth Carpenter was almost sheepish about it. I certainly got mocked for it, he said with a laugh. The reasons for the Fed's errors were systemic, and they illuminated how the Fed used its unrivaled research capacity. When trying to figure out the future, Carpenter relied on a macroeconomic model called the FRB/US model. That model assumed that economic conditions would over time revert to the historically normal state. Interest rates, inflation, and unemployment would all tend to go back to the levels where they had been over the previous decade. The shortcomings of most macro models is that the vast majority of them make the assumption that over time conditions will revert to the prevailing norm, Carpenter said. When taken together, the mistakes made it seem as if a new round of QE would be an emergency action that would quickly boost growth and create jobs, and which could then be repealed so everything could return to normal. If that was true, then quantitative easing would be a tool like others used by the Fed, like interest rate cuts that could be imposed and then quickly withdrawn as conditions changed. The truth turned out to be the opposite. The distortions from quantitative easing were deep and long-lasting, and the program, once employed, was essentially never-ending. These forecasting errors were not an isolated incident. Central banks around the world consistently misled themselves about the effects of quantitative easing. The banks overestimated QE's positive impact on overall economic output when compared against studies conducted by outside researchers, according to a 2020 study by the National Bureau of Economic Research. And central bank researchers who reported larger effects from quantitative easing tended to advance faster in their careers, the study found, huh? So in other words, you toe the party line and put the right research out there that we want to see. This could have been due to the fact that the researchers reported to the very central bank leaders who were pushing for the programs. Dennis Lockhart, president of the Atlanta Fed, was clearly torn about it. I have some reservations about going down the path of a new QE, he said. This time around, it seems to me that we face a more conventional problem of inadequate demand, and I am not convinced that lowering general market rates will stimulate much credit expansion and spending. Sandra, president of the Cleveland Fed, said that another round of quantitative easing would not help as much as the earlier rounds and that it would be hard to end once it started. These arguments were tame compared to the arguments of the non-voting members like Richard Fisher and Esther George, who had replaced Tom Hawning as the president of the Kansas City Fed. They argued that the plan would be ineffective, that exiting it would be difficult, and that the Fed was building up longer-term risks that were difficult to measure, let alone mitigate. Bernanke's answer to these concerns was the same as it had been since the financial crisis. The Fed had to have the courage to act. Congress was clearly sitting on the sidelines. Growth was slow. The benefit of quantitative easing might be small, but if the Fed had the power to gain even small advantages, then it had an obligation to do so. Bernanke admitted that another round of quantitative easing was essentially a shot in the proverbial dark. Now, I wonder, did we ever hear that on the news? Like when we were watching the news, did we ever hear Bernanke say that the quantitative easing was going to be a proverbial shot in the dark? But he believed there were risks to not taking the shot. And just as important, they all needed to support his shot in the dark once it was made. The vote that day was a familiar one. In spite of their concerns, 11 of the FOMC members voted for the plan. Only one voted against it. The single dissenting vote this time came from Jeffrey Lacker, the Richmond Fed president. Lacker's dissent didn't really matter. It could be explained away as the stubborn action of a cranky regional bank president. What did matter was the fact that Fed governors like Betsy Duke and Jay Powell supported the plan. Duke had been won over because option B was crafted in a way that gave the Fed flexibility. The adoption didn't set an end date or a specific amount of bond purchases, which gave the FOMC the freedom to either intensify the program or reduce it, depending on the state of the economy. I genuinely believed that it was a temporary program and that our balance sheet would go back to normal, she later recalled. Almost immediately, she was proven wrong. Almost immediately, she was proven wrong. So we have this whole presentation, this whole dog and pony show put on, and the whole thing was basically a joke. The whole model was a joke. The whole presentation was a joke. It was just, it was literally described as being catastrophic in what it had projected. And yet here's Ben Bernanke saying that, oh, well, this whole thing is basically just a shot in the dark, but we have to do something. Well, why? Because he was getting pressure from the Obama administration to act, to stimulate the economy, to get something going because the economy was stuck in neutral and wasn't going anywhere. And despite the fact that these number of Federal Reserve presidents had a lot of apprehension and they understood that QE was going to be very easy to get in and out of. It was going to be very, very difficult, if not impossible, to get out of. Once you went down this road, it was going to stoke asset inflation. It was going to create a lot of bubbles. It was going to implant a dramatic amount of inherent risk into the overall economy. And if things went badly, the Fed was going to be stuck and there wasn't going to be a whole lot they were going to be able to do. So now let's go into the fundamental QE mistake and the mini insurrection. Within 3 months of launching the plan, the Fed's fundamental mistake was apparent. By January, the average dealer on Wall Street expected the Fed to keep purchasing assets through the end of 2013, buying about $1 trillion in securities during the year. In reality, the Fed was only planning to purchase about $500 billion that year and planned to make the purchases only through June. This was particularly frustrating for Betsy Duke. She had voted for the program only because she believed that it would be limited. Now the market was expecting something far bigger. We got comfortable with a $500 billion program, but nobody in the markets even knew it was a $500 billion program. It immediately went to $1 trillion, $1.1 trillion, immediately. This imposed a choice on the FOMC. The committee could either expand the program or tell the investors that they were mistaken. It's either going to be we end up with a program we never intended, because we don't want to disappoint markets, or markets end up disappointed at the size of the program. One of those was going to happen. Some members of the FOMC, such as Janet Yellen, would be fine with a trillion third round of quantitative easing, but Duke was not. Neither, it became clear, was Jay Powell. During the FOMC's January 2013 meeting, Powell abandoned his tone of moderation. Instead, he delivered a warning about the dangers and distortions of quantitative easing that was blunt. Powell said that the Fed was potentially creating an asset bubble in the markets for debt-like corporate bonds and leveraged loans. And the correction, when it came, could be deeply damaging. Many fixed income securities are now trading well above fundamental value, and the eventual correction could be large and dynamic. Powell was clearly saying that the Fed might be laying the foundation for another financial crash or a large and dynamic event, as he put it. This was around the time when Duke and Powell joined together to push back against Bernanke. They were joined by the former Harvard professor, Jeremy Stein, who became a Fed governor along with Powell. The three governors began to meet and compare notes. They united around a common goal, to force the Fed to stick with the program it had originally envisioned. This meant that they wanted to start winding down the asset purchases sometime around June. Bernanke knew about this mini insurrection, and he soon started describing Duke, Powell, and Stein as the three amigos. They posed a political problem for him. If they were to dissent in unison, it could bring an end to the program. During the March meeting, Powell presented the findings from his own personal survey of 75 investment managers. Many worked for exactly the kind of institutions that were being pushed by the ZIRP policies to make riskier and riskier investments. They included pension funds, insurance companies, and endowments. 64% of them said the Fed was incentivizing people to make investments that didn't make sense. 74% were worried that the Fed would not be able to easily exit the quantitative easing program, even if it wanted to. 84% said the Fed was inflating the value of assets like corporate junk debt. They generally supported the Fed's efforts to have an accommodative policy, but they doubted the effectiveness of quantitative easing. The Fed was purchasing $85 billion in assets every month. In January 2013, Fed staff had estimated that the new round of QE would ultimately add $750 billion to the bank's balance sheet. But by March, even $750 billion was starting to look like a conservative estimate if the Fed didn't pull back or end the purchases. So now, remember when we talked about earlier about how, you know, Bernanke had all the Fed governors on board and that he created an atmosphere where if you wanted to come to dissent as a Fed president, it was basically like, you know, the vote was already like a foregone conclusion. So the Fed presidents would basically put in their comments or whatever. And, you know, Bernanke would, he would allow one dissenter, but no more than that. Because, and this is exactly why, if the three of these, if Bernanke and Powell and Stein and Duke, if the three of them had voted in unison, that was end game. That was game over. It was all done. And so Bernanke could not allow that to happen. So he had to go into kind of overdrive here. And we're going to see here in a second with his compromise. He had to get the, he had to get these guys back under, you know, back under, under control here and get rolling. So Bernanke met with Stein and Powell. He continued negotiating with Duke. The three governors were unwavering. They wanted the FOMC to impose discipline on the program and cut back purchases. Eventually, Bernanke reached a compromise with the three amigos. After the meeting in June, Bernanke would announce that the Fed might start slowing down its new QE program. The goal was to clearly tell Wall Street traders that the QE program wasn't going to surpass $1 trillion, and it certainly wasn't going to last forever, as some traders seem to believe. Duke and Powell agreed to this compromise. After the June meeting, Bernanke walked to the press room to deliver the news. Bernanke was the first Fed president to give regularly scheduled press conferences. He began the practice in April of 2011. To help quell the political backlash that followed quantitative easing, after the blowback that greeted our introduction of QE2 in November 2010, we needed to do more than ever to explain our policies clearly and effectively. The tactic was remarkably effective. Carola Binder, the economist who studied media coverage of the Fed, found that most outlets never covered FOMC meetings unless Bernanke held a news conference. When that happened, the cameras put the focus on Bernanke himself, allowing him to shape the message. So that the mainstream media focused exclusively on Bernanke and, you know, didn't give any of the other presidents or FOMC members, you know, a whole lot of airtime or a whole lot of coverage. And that allowed Ben Bernanke to kind of control the narrative here of what was going on. Bernanke started with a prepared statement, and in the midst of it, he said that quantitative easing was essentially temporary. The Fed would likely taper off its purchases if growth remained strong and would consider ending the program around June of 2014. Bernanke soft-pedaled the announcement as much as he could, emphasizing that the Fed would still keep interest rates near zero. Bernanke equivocated. Obviously, there's no change. There's no change in policy involved here. There's simply a clarification, helping people to think about where policy might evolve. Bernanke's language remained vague and open-ended, but even as he was talking, traders on Wall Street were executing orders based on what he said. They had heard one thing above all else: quantitative easing would be reduced, and it would probably be reduced sooner rather than later. What happened next was often described as the kind of market shock or an unforeseen spasm of volatility, but it was in fact an entirely measured reaction to the idea that the Fed would slow down QE. This reaction became known as the taper tantrum. The taper tantrum was the first of multiple market shocks that would illustrate the profound fragility that ZERP and QE had embedded in the financial system. And it helped to it is helpful to understand this by thinking of the financial system as a seesaw. On the one end of the seesaw, there are risky investments like stocks or corporate debt. On the other end of the seesaw, there are very safe investments like the 10-year treasury bonds. Money travels back and forth from end to end on the seesaw, depending on how bold investors feel. Since 2010, the Fed had been pushing money away from the safe end of the seesaw where the 10-year treasury bill sat. This was the whole point of QE, to force investors to push their money over to the risky end of the seesaw because the Fed was keeping interest rates low on 10-year treasury bills by purchasing so many of them. So interest rates fall on treasury bills when the Fed buys them because the Fed is increasing demand for those bills. When demand is high, a borrower has to pay less money in interest to get a loan, hence rates fall. So when Bernanke indicated that the Fed would be buying fewer 10-year treasury bills, the money started to move back over to the safe end of the seesaw and away from the risky assets. This is when the seesaw tips, and it would do so with increasing velocity as the Fed's interventions became more extreme. The most obvious symptom of the taper tantrum was a sudden decline in stock market values. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell by 1.35% almost immediately on the chairman's remarks, but the stock market was actually a sideshow. The real danger showed up in the market for the 10-year treasury bills. The interest rate on 10-year treasury shot up the day of Bernanke's announcement by 0.126%. That might not sound like much, but in the world of ultra-safe treasury bills, it was a massive and jarring movement. The rate would jump over half a percentage point from 2.2% the day before Bernanke's press conference to 2.73% within weeks. This movement didn't register as a financial crisis or even a market crash for most Americans, but it felt like the beginning of a crisis inside Wall Street. Everybody could see what would happen if the money started rushing to the safe side of the seesaw and left the risky investments to survive with less cash. The balance of risk was changing quickly. Rising yields on treasuries meant that Wall Street might have a savings account again, and investors didn't need to keep their money out on the risky side of the yield curve. When this fact was apparent, investors turned around and looked at all the risky junk they bought, like leveraged loans and corporate junk bonds. They could now dump those investments and put their money somewhere safer. This was what started happening in late June and early July, and it happened in the kind of arcane markets where the Fed's QE money flowed. Real estate investment trusts, REITs, began forced selling their holdings as mortgage rates adjusted. Money fled from corporate bonds, and indebted companies saw their interest rates rise. Basically, this is exactly what we've seen played out over the last year and a half as the Fed increased interest rates. We've seen money go from one end of the seesaw to the other. People have now found safer places to put their investments. And you know, we've seen this. The REITs began forced selling their holdings as mortgage rates have adjusted. Money fled from corporate bonds. The indebted companies saw their interest rate rise. All this stuff is playing out now. Betsy Duke was watching the taper tantrum play out on the television set in her office. She also had a Bloomberg computer terminal providing real-time financial data. Her heart sank as she watched the treasury rate spike. It reflected an almost instantaneous wiping out of all the work the Fed had just done. So many billions had been pumped into the banking system to push down treasury rates, and now the declines were disappearing. At that point, it forced the Fed to be even more committed to continuing on, she said. There just kind of wasn't any choice at that point. They had to continue and had to bring reassurance to the market that they were going to continue. The plan to taper was abandoned. In other words, they have gotten into QE and now there was no way out. They had to keep rolling it because if they didn't roll it, the market was going to correct. The market was going to crash. So now let's move down here to our last side. So so we went through the temper tantrum. Now we're going to go into QE. No end in sight. So the new round of quantitative easing had started as a small commitment in 2012. It was sold as an insurance policy, as a contingency plan that could be withdrawn. In January 2013, the internal FOMC memo described the QE plan as a program that would end in June of 2013 and would add $750 billion to the Fed's balance sheet. Instead, the program continued through September. Then it continued into December. It was only then that the Fed started to even diminish the size of its monthly purchases, but it did not stop them. The quantitative easing program continued through June of 2014 and then into October of 2014. Finally, the Fed stopped making purchases that month in October of 2014. The $750 billion program ended as a $1.6 trillion program. The program's quick withdrawal, which had been forecast in the presentation by Seth Carpenter, never materialized. The Fed would not even attempt to start shrinking its holdings until October 2017. And even then, the effort was halting and largely unsuccessful. Ben Bernanke and the FOMC had fundamentally redrawn the economic landscape and the rules of monetary policy. So now, Betsy Duke announced in July 2013 that she was leaving the Fed board. At one of her final meetings in June, she said that she wanted to cast a dissenting vote. The quantitative easing policy had gone on for far too long and had grown too large, but she voted along with the majority. The time to oppose it would have been at the beginning. Geez, that's really nice that she kind of came to that conclusion at the very end after all the damage was done. And then finally here, the effects of QE and Powell's warnings. So the Fed was locked into the asset purchases and the program was creating new levels of debt across corporate America while also inflating asset prices. This wasn't an unintended consequence of QE. It was the goal. One of the Fed's own economists, David Reifschneider, clearly explained during the FOMC meeting in 2012 that ZIRP policies boosted growth through three channels: cost of capital, wealth effects, and the exchange rate. Translated, this meant the QE made debt cheaper, stoked asset prices, and devalued the dollar, which could boost exports. At the same meeting, economist William English said QE would boost asset prices and adding more QE would boost them higher. In March of 2013, the Fed economist Nellie Liang told the FOMC that low interest rates were already inflating asset prices, possibly stoking bubbles. This wasn't a forecast based on models, but an assessment based on the Fed's unparalleled market surveillance. But some of the most dire and most prescient warnings came from Jay Powell. While financial conditions are a net positive, there's also reason to be concerned about the growing market distortions created by our continuing asset purchases. He warned that the Fed was wrong to presume that it could clean up the mess after a bubble burst. In any case, we ought to have a low level of confidence that we can regulate or manage our way around the kind of large dynamic market event that becomes increasingly likely thanks to our policy. Powell was concerned about one market in particular, the market for exotic, risky corporate debt. This was the kind of debt that private equity firms and hedge funds used to buy other companies. The debt, sometimes in the form of leverage loans, was packaged and resold, just as home loans had been during the 2000s. Back then, home loans were packaged into something called a collateralized debt obligation, or CDO. In 2013, corporate debt was being resold as something called a collateralized loan obligation, or a CLO. When Powell talked about leveraged loans and buyouts, he was describing his own life experience. He had spent a good part of his career engineering exactly the kinds of risky debt that was now warning that he was now warning about. As it happened, Powell's experience in the private equity world would become directly intertwined with his experience at the Federal Reserve. So we're now in a situation where the Fed is stuck in QE. They're moving forward. QE is having the intended effect. It's having the desired effect. Asset prices are rising. Growth is going. So you have the cost of capital is being kept low. There's the conceded wealth effect. The exchange rate's where they want it. So all this stuff is necessarily working how they wanted it. But you also have a lot of concerns. You know, we're inflating risky debt. We're stoking asset bubbles. We're building all this risk into the general economy. And QE is not necessarily working in the way that we had intended it to work in terms of job creation, in terms of stoking a tremendous amount of growth in the economy. So, and you have Powell still sitting there warning about if we have this huge market implosion, you know, we're not going to be able to do any, we're going to be powerless basically to do anything about it. So that's where we leave off here. That's the end of chapter 7. And the next chapter is called The Fixer, where we're going to get into the background story of Jeremy Powell. We're going to be talking also in that chapter a lot more about collateralized loan obligations, or CLO. So again, and with that, I'll just wrap up. So again, I really hope you guys are enjoying the series. I know this episode was a little longer. This was one of the longer chapters in the book. But again, I hope if you haven't checked out the first 8 episodes of this ongoing series, I hope you will get kind of caught up. And I will be back next time with episode 10. We're going to go over chapter 8, The Fixer, and I will see you all again real soon. Thank you so much.